G'day gang, hope you're terrific. So today's a little bit different. I was thinking about what, I don't have a guest for today, which is I have actually a guest for tomorrow. I'm recording this Sunday. Tomorrow, Paul Taylor, everyone's favourite guest, is back on. Paul Taylor. And I was thinking about what, if anything, I might do today, and it dawned on me that there's something that I constantly work on and something I've had in the background on planet me for 100 years that nobody knows about. And that is, I have this kind of, I guess you'd call it an electronic journal. And whenever I have a thought or an idea, sometimes I'll have the beginning of an idea or the beginning of something big, but initially it's just a thread. It's just maybe it's a word, maybe it's a phrase, maybe it's an initial idea or concept or something that I feel like there's a door opening in my brain or my creative self or my, you know, spiritual self where there's something coming and I think, yeah, this is something I need to just jot down. So I jot those things down and sometimes it'll be a paragraph, sometimes, like I said, it'll be a few words or an idea or a question or a thought, and I jot it down, and then invariably I go back to that and I'll build on it and I'll go back and I'll just read what I've written in the last few days. And there's no rhyme or reason. It's literally just a Word document with probably about 250,000 words. So think about the biggest book I've written, which is Pull Your Finger Out, is 80,000 words. That's 280 pages, so this is about three times that comfortably. So it's the best part of, I guess it would be 700 or 800 pages of thoughts and ideas, and nobody's ever read it. It's just a fucking hodgepodge anyway, really. It'd just be, not that I wouldn't want anyone to read it, but it's just some of them, sometimes it's a sentence I wrote 4 years ago and never went back there, and sometimes it's something that I've revisited. And sometimes I'll take something from there and I'll just cut and paste it and share it. You know, sometimes, for example, I'll be driving and I will have a thought or an idea and I literally need to pull over, stop the car and talk into this thing I'm talking into right now, either talk into my voice recorder on my phone, or I need to, you know, go into notes and write some things down because I can't relax or I can't focus on anything else until I get that out of my head. So what I wanted to do with you or do today is just share some of that stuff. And so I've called this Once Upon a Fucking Time, and they're not really stories, they're just things out of my head that I think some of you have heard. Some of them I've shared on camps and in programs. Some of them you will have never heard. Most of them I've never shared, or probably at least half I've never shared in public. So I thought each one is like a little self-contained message. So, I probably should have been a bit more strategic about this, but I literally jumped on this morning and I just plucked off, maybe 10 or 12 random things. They're not related. There's no intelligent chronology with this. There's no segue from one to the other. Just a bit of food for thought. So the first one is about Facebook, believe it or not. Well, the first idea or thought or message is about Facebook. And this is something I wrote a while ago and uploaded, but I thought I might share it again. Facebook is not good or bad. It's a free communication tool that humans use in different ways for different reasons and with different agendas. And I guess this is me freestyling now. I guess the reason that I wrote this was because we are constantly being bombarded with debates about social media, Facebook and Instagram and Twitter and what else is there? All the other bits and pieces, I guess even YouTube. What's that other one? I don't know. I'm old. You feel me. But in the middle of it, I'm more objective and less emotional. And I stand back and I think, is it really about the, is it Because ultimately, Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or YouTube or any of those platforms are just electronic resources that we can use or not use. It's completely optional. And what we do or say or share on them is all about the individual. Like, the actual platform itself is doing nothing other than fucking just hovering out there in social media land, and then we jump on there and post something, and that something doesn't come from Facebook or Twitter or Instagram. It comes out of our head, and then we use that medium to share that. Anyway, Facebook is not good or bad. It's a free communication tool that humans use in different ways for different reasons and with different agendas, just like people use podcast platforms like I'm doing right now. Some of those humans like me use it primarily as a medium to share thoughts, ideas, and messages that will hopefully help encourage and or educate people towards better choices, mindset, behaviors, and outcomes, which for me makes Facebook awesome. I do this in the hope that I'm doing something positive for people. That is my intention. And obviously, we're all aware that some humans use Facebook and the like to hurt, intimidate, threaten, criticize, judge, condemn, and hate. But I think it's important to draw the distinction between, one, the person sharing the hate, and two, the free resource that most of us use in a positive way, most of my followers anyway. I'm tired of people saying Facebook is bad. No, Facebook is just a tool that reveals how some people think, behave, and live. Facebook doesn't post hateful, hurtful messages. Humans do. Seeing Facebook as the problem is analogous to thinking that cars are the problem when a drunk driver kills someone. It's not about the car, it's about the driver. Or perhaps more specifically, I guess, the alcohol that the driver's consumed, chosen to consume. It's not about the social media platform, it's about what people choose to do with it. This next one is something that I wrote a few years ago, and it's brief, it's really brief, but I called it the Delusionite. And I don't know if anyone else uses it, but my friend Tony Doherty uses that term all the time. And I love it. It makes me laugh. Anyway, so this is called the Delusionite. A guy is driving home from work in his old neglected car when he becomes aware that he's surrounded by rattles and grinding noises, leaks and strange smells, bald tires and smoke pouring from the engine. He figures, well, it hasn't stopped yet, so he keeps driving and driving. And 100 metres from home, not surprisingly, the car finally dies, dead, flatlines. A few friends help him push the old clunker home and into the driveway. He locks the car up and walks inside, thinking that somehow it will start in the morning. Clearly, he didn't pay attention to the enormous bang or the engine fire. So the next morning, he gets up and he walks to his car, and for some inexplicable reason, he thinks that the car might have fixed itself. Well, it hasn't. The next day, he goes through the same ritual, and the next day, and the next day, curiously thinking that some kind of automotive miracle might be around the corner. Well, days turn into months, and months turn into years, and for no logical reason, he continues to believe that one day, somehow, his car will fix itself and run smoothly. And obviously, it never does. Well, for some of us, that car is our life. Alrighty, so I've shared this a few times. Some of you may have heard it. I may have even put it, I think, I'm not sure. I write so much and record so much, I can't remember where I put stuff, so to speak. This may be somewhere in the online program. There's 11 and a half hours or so of content there, so I can't remember everything, but definitely worth a reshare. So this is quite deep and philosophical. And the reason that I often talk about the body and health and appearance and who we are inside and outside our body, I guess, is because so many people have body stuff, me included, and that's my background. I come from, that space of helping people with their body and their behaviours and thinking and habits around all of that, but it never really goes away. So for a lot of people, body issues don't really ever disappear. The volume kind of goes up and down a little bit, and we may master it more or we may get on top of it more, but the food stuff or the self-esteem stuff or the insecurity stuff or the I love me or I hate me stuff, kind of for a lot of us, it hangs around. So it's really about just managing that, managing those feelings, managing those insecurities and trying to figure out, you know, who we are beyond that thing that we see in the mirror. So this is called Your Body and You. Your body is an amazing gift, but it is not you, and you are not it. You have one, but you are not one. You can respect it, appreciate it, love it, and live in it, but you can never be it. Unlike your body, you are not physical, but for now, your body is your physical home. It's how I can find you, know where you are. And while I can see it, I can't see you until I look past everything that you are not. I know it gets deep, I told you. In fact, nobody can see you until you choose to reveal yourself to them, which is something you rarely do. I suspect that you and your body have a complicated relationship and at times a painful one. Welcome to a very large club, but maybe it's time to stop looking for yourself in the mirror because you don't live there. It's important for you to understand that where you live, your physical body, is not who you are. And I share this because for much of your life, you have been misinformed, misled. Unhealthy lessons from misguided voices have taught you to believe that your physical appearance somehow defines you. It doesn't. You are so much more than a reflection in some glass, so much more than an appearance, an image, a face, a weight, a size, a number. You are the genius, the beauty, the awareness, and the consciousness that comes to understand what you are not. And, yeah, that can be confusing. You might need to listen to it again or think about it. But, you know, the truth is that so many of us get caught up in this idea that what I look like is who I am. And when we get caught up in the what I look like is who I am paradigm, then all of a sudden we find our sense of self and self-esteem and confidence and identity in the mirror. And that's a really really dangerous place to find ourselves, because when I get my entire sense of self from my appearance or my body in general, I'm on a slippery slope because my body is going to deteriorate. Of course, I'll do everything I can to maintain it and make smart decisions and have a healthy diet, tickety tick tick, of course. But we're not talking so much about health maintenance. We're talking about getting our self-esteem and sense of confidence and identity from our appearance. And when we do that, we're in a really vulnerable place, and insecurity will be our default setting, because that pretty face, those big muscles, that amazing figure, that amazing six-pack or whatever it is, it's going to disappear. It's going to disappear over time. And so when we have a life that is built around or a pursuit of happiness or identity that's built around what I look like, life's going to be tough. So this next one is called The Happiness Certainty Conundrum. I don't know when I wrote this, a while ago. So here's the conundrum. We want to be certain about anything and everything that might happen to us or around us, yet at the same time, we want to be happy. So our dilemma lies in the fact that for many of us, our level of happiness is linked to our level of certainty. One is dependent on the other. We like being sure about stuff and we hate being unsure. It makes us feel vulnerable and unsafe, which makes us unhappy. And as a result, we strive for absolute certainty about everything. On some level, we want to know the unknowable. We want to be certain that we're not being lied to. Good luck with that. And that our kids won't use drugs or date a loser. Good luck with that one too. Or be hurt. We want to be certain that we'll make it to heaven, although we're not really sure that it exists, but we'll do the right thing just in case, as kind of an eternal guarantee. We want to be certain that our partner won't cheat on us and that people won't discover our secret. We want to be certain that we're financially secure and that we'll live happily ever after. Well, the uncomfortable truth is that almost everything about the human experience is uncertain. Love, health, friendships, careers, situations, circumstances, events, the government, the economy, life. Of course, many things are probable or likely, but very few certain. Nobody can know with certainty what tomorrow will bring. Just watch the nightly news. For many of us, the fact that our ability to be happy is impaired by our need for certainty makes sustained happiness almost impossible. So if anything, our need for certainty, which often arises from a fear of the unknown, is more likely to produce anxiety and discontent than it is any kind of lasting joy or calm. Our need for certainty is an unnecessary psychological and emotional anchor, and it keeps many of us trapped in a self-created prison. So the relevant question is not, can you find certainty, but rather, can you find happiness without it? So I always seem to be navigating the let's not offend anyone conversation. The Craig, you swear too much, you're inappropriate, why do you need to talk that way, or why do you need to be so blunt? Can you not use the word fat? Can you use another word? Can you not do this? Can you do that? And so on. And so, not surprisingly, it's an area that I'm really interested in, and I'm genuinely interested in the way that people get offended, create offense, get offended, be offended, are offended from a cognitive perspective, from the way that we interpret things, tell ourselves stories, and then create experiences. And I'm not, by the way, saying people should be offended or shouldn't be. I'm not actually judging the response, but rather talking about the response. And I've always found it interesting that one particular stimulus can create such a broad range of individual reactions, from, you know, absolute disgust through to absolute hilarity and laughter and everything in between. So this little piece that I wrote is about being offended. Being offended is a personal reaction to something that the next person won't find offensive, which is why some of my followers, a minority, get offended by my swearing. Some are amused, some love it, and others don't give a fuck, so to speak. The experience of being offended is a byproduct of the story an individual tells him or herself about an external stimulus, what it means to them, a word, a behavior, a standard, an attitude, an experience. And the challenge of even opening this door into subjective reality, storytelling, and human psychology around this topic is that statistically, someone will find a way to be offended even by these words I'm sharing now, while others will find it an interesting commentary on the personal nature of the human experience. And before anyone goes off at a tangent thinking that this post is about what is and what isn't offensive, it's not. It's about metacognition. It's about becoming more aware of and responsible for how we think, why we think the way we do, and how we can consciously create our experiences around that awareness. So this may be one of the things that I've written or shared. I can't remember it. I've just had a glimpse at it now, and I feel like this will piss someone off. Or maybe they'll get pissed off. But it's something that I've always found amusing and, I guess, potentially frustrating and annoying. It's called the Accolade Brigade. But Craig, I've been so good. You'd be amazed at the number of people who seek some kind of praise or accolade from me for simply not doing stupid shit to their body, like they're 5 years old and showing me a painting. Somehow the self-management bar has been set so low that some people want a gold medal for not eating cake, for going for a fucking walk, for getting mildly uncomfortable, for 2 days in a row. Good grief. Are we really so fragile and so undisciplined and so weak and so lazy that we need a cheer squad just for doing something responsible? For not destroying our health with stupid choices and stupid behaviours? You're not a hero for eating healthy food and moving your body. Nobody is. You're a mature adult living in an irreplaceable biological home, making a smart decision. Doing the right thing for your body is not amazing. It's intelligent. It's not special. It's required. And you definitely don't need a fucking cheer squad. When all the bullshit, the self-help fluff and the temporary motivation disappears, all that's left is you. You and your choices. You and your behaviour. You and your story. What will your story be? So this is something that, this is around programming and the way that we think and the way that we, I kind of bang on a little bit about the way that we create our experiences, for better or worse, that this idea of subjective reality is that life happens to us, around us, good things, bad things, situation, circumstance, environment, other people, work, money, the government, the economy, the weather, all of those things happen to us and around us. And then in the middle of that, we create an experience. And the experiences that we create are really a byproduct of our thinking and our programming and our stories and our values and our internal sat nav. And I love opening this door, because what I'm trying to do when I open this door is to help us step into metacognition, which is really thinking about thinking, which is starting to have awareness around how I am and who I am and why I communicate the way I do and why I react the way I do and whether or not it serves me or sabotages me, and where do my beliefs come from and where do my values come and where do my hopes and dreams and expectations come from and my fears come from and how does all of that stuff make me me? And so I love the idea of us becoming, you, me, becoming more conscious about our own reality and the creation of our own reality and the creation of our own experiences. And even when somebody like me, that some of you respect and listen to and read and interact with, when I say something or share something or write something, I don't want you to buy into it or to believe it or embrace it just because you trust me or like me. I want you to consider what I'm saying and see whether or not, based on your internal sat nav, your values, your beliefs, based on all of those things, whether or not what I'm saying or writing or sharing, whether or not that makes sense for you, whether or not that resonates for you, whether or not that feels true for you. Because the things that I share, especially the wisdom that I share, is not my wisdom. It's just wisdom. It's just, you know, when I say that working through discomfort makes us stronger, that helps us build resilience, this is nothing I invented. When I say that asking great questions leads to often better decisions, behaviors, and outcomes, I didn't invent that. This is not new. You know, when that I say that, you know, I am not my body, it's just where I live, this is not something I created. This is not a Craig Harper revelation. This is just a truth. We all exist beyond our body. We all exist beyond our things. We all exist beyond our appearance and external identity. And so this is really, this is opening the door a little bit deeper. But for me, this is the shit that blows my hair back. This is the fucking stuff that, for me, like, this is what I believe that being alive is about, being human is about, being a conscious creator, not an unconscious passenger in someone else's car or an unconscious character in someone else's story, but rather the conscious creator and the conscious author of our own story. So this is called Who's Programming You? From the moment you were born, you were influenced, trained, directed, instructed, molded, and educated. You were programmed by your environment, experiences, encounters, and the people in your world. like a computer with arms and legs, you had data punched into your cerebral hard drive on a daily basis. Consciously or not, intentionally or not, that data became your version of reality, your understanding of life, of people, of truth, and even of yourself. It became, for better or worse, it became your default setting. It became the window through which you viewed, analysed, and interpreted the world around you. Over time, you came to know how things worked, or so you believed. You knew that there was or wasn't a God, because that's what you were taught. You were also aware that your sporting team was awesome and the rest were rubbish because Dad said. You knew that you were meant to get married, probably by a certain age, have kids, and then mould them just as you'd been moulded. You understood what rituals should be followed and what kind of career might be pursued, which rules should be obeyed, and what was and wasn't acceptable behaviour in a broad range of situations. You were taught who to respect and trust, and you were told who to distrust. And on some level, you were told what to believe, how to think, and what to do. And in some ways, you didn't get a chance to know you or be you because you were becoming a version of everyone else, a version of those in your world. And now here you are listening to this, all grown up, a product of your programming. And so now what to do with this awareness? What if there's a better way for you? What if there is a better way for you to think and for you to choose and for you to create and connect and learn and to do life? In fact, what if there's a better way for you to be you, to understand who you are and who you might become beyond what you've been told and taught and trained to be? To step out of the shadow of other people's thoughts, expectations, and ideas, and into the light of your own discoveries, your own beliefs, your own purpose, and your own truth. So if these words resonate, then maybe it's time to block out the external noise and tune into your own internal wisdom, your sat nav, the knowing within, to trust yourself and to start writing a new story, your story. So I guess I've had thousands of conversations over the years with people who have, for a range of reasons, been disappointed in somebody in their life, a significant person, a family member or friend or partner or kid. And, you know, as much as we love those people, sometimes there are people in our world who, for a range of reasons, keep doing things which aren't particularly desirable or clever or healthy. And we, coming from a place of love and support, quite often try to change them, not a great idea generally, or help or support them, better idea, educate them. But often it doesn't always work out great, does it? And sometimes we get disappointed because we expect that they will behave the way that we want them to behave or react the way that we hope that they will react. And when we know that the best predictor of future behavior, like it or not, folks, the best predictor of future behavior is past behavior, then it's probably not always great to expect them to be different. Hope, maybe, support, maybe, but expecting is probably going to set us up for disappointment. So, and by the way, that doesn't mean people can't change. Of course, people can change. But if somebody's done something, responded a particular way the last 100 times, then there's a fair chance today might be a similar response. So this is called the expectation disappointment correlation, which sounds like an episode of The Big Bang or something. People don't disappoint you, no. People teach you what to expect from them via their typical and predictable behaviours over time. Especially those in your world with a long history of doing the same silly, destructive, self-serving, toxic bullshit. Now, this doesn't make it what they do right or comfortable, but it makes it easier for you to predict what's probably coming, like it or not, in terms of choices and behaviours and their reliability. Your disappointment is a byproduct of your hopeful but irrational expectation that they will somehow magically behave differently today. Deep down, you know they probably won't. So is this negative counsel? No. It's practical. Is it realistic? Yes. It's an intelligent approach to managing and protecting yourself mentally and emotionally around certain people's behavior and selfishness. And of course, people can and do change, and let's encourage and support them, of course. But let's also be practical about what we should expect from those who have given us a very clear message via their behaviors and choices for way longer than we'd like to think about. So this last one is really personal and deep, and this is really just me sharing almost like a personal mantra. And I actually put this on social media today as a written post, but it was just fresh in my mind, in my consciousness, and I thought I would share it because it's very meaningful. And by the way, what I'm about to share, I often don't live up to. This is my aspiration. This is what I try to live, but don't always. Fuck up daily, but consistently trying. My individual identity, brand, reputation is unimportant, but what is important is the ideology, belief, and value system that I represent. What is important is my ability to serve others, to empower people to face their fears, to bring value to the world, to love without expectation. What matters on the deepest level is the message I share and the impact it has. It's not my wisdom or genius, but it is wisdom and genius nonetheless. I take no credit for it because I created none of it. I am merely a beneficiary of its power. It is a truth that was here before me and a truth that will be here when I'm gone. I'm not powerful or great. I'm merely a conduit to that which is powerful and great. I'm a solution to nothing, and I am not the gift. I'm the student and the teacher. I think that'll do on that philosophical deep note, kids. So have a good night.